सतो मा सत्गमय तमसो मा ज्योतिर्गमय मृत्योर्मामृतं गमय ॐ असतो मा सत्गमय तमसो मा ज्योतिर्गमय मृत्योर्मामृतं गमय असतो मा सत्गमय तमसो
Good afternoon, good evening, welcome. It's really, as always, a pleasure, a joy, a delight, and an incredible experience of community, satsang, and grace to be connected with you on this call. So, we are on week 3 of our class in Transforming the Mind, based on the Yoga Vasishtha, and we have been examining the most basic cut-to-the-chase understanding, the one that, once we get it, will all by itself transform your experience of the mind. And just for a moment, I'm going to ask Karen LeDuc to press star 7 and tell me that everyone is hearing me, just to have a double check. So, Karen, I see your name there. Will you press star 7 if you and say, hello, I'm here? Okay. So I'm hoping that you all can hear me. Deb, can you, if you hear me, press star 7 and say hello. Are you there?
I can hear you.
Sally. Okay, perfect.
Yeah,
thank you.
Hear you.
Okay, great.
Sure.
Just checking. Thank you. Okay. So you can remute yourself and again, welcome. So, what we've been talking about, and in our first class, perhaps the conversation was too intense for the instant teleseminar connection because it cut out from time to time. What we have been examining is the understanding that the source of the mind, the place from which the mind arises, is pure consciousness. That this consciousness holds all reality within itself, and that what we experience as this world is actually a series of thoughts arising within the one great mind. And everything that arises from that recognition, which is the recognition of classical Vedanta, it's also, as it happens, the recognition of all the great non-dual traditions, including Buddhism, including even Kashmir Shaiva Tantra, this understanding that, as Vashistha says, just as a bracelet and a ring are both made of gold, in the same way, our thoughts, our bodies, the physical environment of the planet are all made of consciousness. So last week we looked at the four essentials of practice, which Vashistha calls the four gatekeepers of the kingdom of liberation. And these are sama, which we translated as tranquility or control of mind, to santosha or acceptance of what is, vichara or inquiry into the nature of reality, and sadhu satsang or the company of truth, which takes the form of teachers, texts, groups of spiritual friends focused on truth. And really speaking, what we've been doing in these last few weeks is really entering into the kingdom through these doorways together and separately, especially with the satsang component, which is so critical for this teaching and for this unfoldment. One of the things that I've been contemplating as I've been enjoying the listserv is that we are actually experiencing the threefold synergy that Buddhism calls the three jewels, and which every tradition, one way or another, invokes, as Vashistha does, as the basis of all of our transformative practice. And in Buddhism, they're called Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha. So Buddha is the teacher. In this case, Vashistha himself. Vashistha's state and his realization are here in the text in a complete flowering, fully flowering form. So invoking him, we have the presence of the Guru, the radically enlightened teacher with us, and his guidance and the transmission that flows through him, and that also is carried through the teachers that I've known through my lineage masters, and also through the inner lineage energies that so many of you carry, as well as the teachers who have been part of your lives. So we have the Buddha, literally, which, of course, the word Buddha means awake one or enlightened one, in our midst. We also have the Dharma, the teachings, which in this case are among the highest and subtlest in any spiritual tradition. And we have the Sangha, which not only is all of us, but also the invisible beings who are standing with and behind all of us and with and behind Vashistha's realization. So the Sangha is never only the human beings whom we are aware of in our immediate environment. The Sangha is everyone who has ever studied, realized, longed for, experienced the truth. And in supporting our practice, we're also supporting the Sangha, and the Sangha is supporting us. So if you ever wonder why these teleclasses can be so powerful and transformative, I would say that in large part it's because of the presence and the intention of the invisible Sangha. You guys, for sure, but also those beings who are present in the noosphere, who are invoked as we tune into these teachings. So we're going to continue by invoking those beings and by really tuning into their power and their intention for us. And the chant that we'll be doing is that we did it last week. It's actually a available. Hopefully you guys have it. And if not, you can just listen. But as we prepare to chant, please find yourself in a posture that's fully, let's say, call it the posture of embodied nobility. So this posture is upright, and it's fully, in your posture, you're fully aware of the contact between your base and your sits bones and your seat, really with the feeling that you're being supported by the earth. And with your inhalation, you let the breath flow down towards the belly, actually flowing around the belly, almost as though you could touch the four corners of the belly, the front, the back, each side. And then with the exhalation, you feel the torso arising, the spinal column elongating gently and subtly through the power of the breath through the crown of the head. The chin is slightly tilted. The back naturally flattens just a little bit as the shoulder blades come onto the back. And as we begin our call with the practice of santosha, of being fully present with our experience in this moment, which may include great stillness, exhaustion, excitement, restlessness. It might include some physical tiredness or aches and pains. Or you might feel very fluid, very open. Your prana might be moving freely, very freely. So however you are experiencing this moment, be present with that. Experience the breath flowing in and out. And as we were doing last week, we are focusing at this moment on the felt sensation of the breath at the tips of the nostrils. This practice of focusing on the breath at the tips of the nostrils, just a little cool coming in, a little warm going out, is one of the core practices for experiencing sama, or tranquility, or pacification of mind. If you'll remember, Vishista says that the movements of the mind, the agitation of the mind, is the result of two factors. One is the movement of prana, and the other is the movement of vasana, which we're going to talk about a little bit at length tonight. So this practice of sama, he says that even though pranayama, the exercises we do to control the prana, to pacify the prana, even though pranayama is not, let's say, the ultimate practice, he says that vichara, or inquiry, is the ultimate practice. Jnana, knowledge, is the ultimate practice. Nonetheless, the practice of attending to the prana, of allowing the prana to become steady and still, he says, will eventually lead you into yogic samadhi, into the state of stillness. Because when the prana becomes still, those of you who practice yoga know this very well, the vasanas, the ripples of the mind, become still. And this very simple, very basic practice of sensing the breath at the nostrils is, let's call it, our default practice for settling the mind. So just a moment or two in contact with the breath at the nostrils. And now we'll chant. You can chant to yourself silently. Yata sarvani bhutani prati banti sthitani cha yatraivo pasanam yanti tasmai satyatmane namaha. Salutations to that reality in which all the elements and all sentient and unsentient beings shine as if they had an independent existence, in which they exist for a time and into which they merge. Yata jnanam tata jnayam drasta darshana drisyabhu kartu hetu kriya yasmat Tasmayanatmane Namaha. Salutations to that consciousness, that awareness, which is the source of the threefold divisions of knower, knowledge, and known, of seer, seeing, and seen, and of doer, doing, and deed.
Spuranti sikara yasmad anandasyam pare vanao sarvesham jivanam tasmai brahmanandatmane namaha.
And this is my favorite. Salutations to that ocean of bliss, which is the life of all beings, whose happiness is derived, that is, our happiness, is derived from the shower of spray from that ocean of bliss. It's such an exquisite image, and it's very key to Vaisheshika's yoga. You know, if anyone thinks that the path of jnana, of knowledge, is without love or bliss, is different from the path of love. In fact, it's not true, as this verse tells us. The ananda of Brahman, the bliss of the Absolute, is the source of this path. And he ends with Om Tat Sat, which means so it is, and Om Namah Shivaya. And in that awareness, we offer our practice, asking that it be of benefit to all beings in all worlds. And as the breath flows, as you sense the breath moving in and out of the nostrils, let's take it one step further into a practice that will be familiar to some of you. Imagine that your body is completely hollow. Your skin, like the membrane of a balloon, encloses pure space. And let yourself experience the breath flowing through this spaciousness inside the body. So as the breath flows into the edge of the nostrils, your attention flows with the breath down into the spaciousness of your own inner body, your hollow body. And as the breath flows out, it comes from who knows where, flowing up from the spaciousness of the body, just the way wind flows in the sky. As you allow the breath to flow through your hollow body, see if you can simultaneously become aware of the presence of this energy vortex. This pure awareness. That we experience as our Sangham. There's a line I came across in the Yoga Vasishtha today, which I actually put up on my Facebook page. He says, he asks a question, which he asks again and again, what is consciousness? What is God? And his answer, God is that reality that exists between you and me. God is that reality that exists between you and me. And in virtual reality, it's a very beautiful way to think of the virtual space. If you have a sheet of paper, if you take a sheet of paper and you fold the corners, each of the corners looks different. They look as though they're on one side or another of the paper. But, of course, behind them all is this one sheet of paper. and it's the paper that makes the corners. And we can't cut the corners off without leaving other corners. In short, the corners cannot be freed from the paper. Now, this is a, you know, slightly clunky analogy, as all physical analogies are, and we're going to do a few more today. But it sort of works. You know, in the same way you and I seem completely different, and we are on different sides of the continent, any of us. But we're held together in consciousness as one, just the way paper stands within one corner and another, but the corners are also within the paper. They're not outside the paper. In the same way, when we say that God is that consciousness that exists between you and me, what it means is that the whole thing is God. The whole thing is consciousness. So, in that sense, and this is what he says again and again in different ways, there is no you and me as separate individuals. The whole thing is God. God as you and God as me and God as the space between us. So another way of saying this is the knower is consciousness, the known, which is your awareness of my voice, my awareness of your presence, and also the body that you experience, the feelings and thoughts that you experience, that's all the known, and the process of knowing, which is the experience of hearing and recognizing that you hear, of feeling and recognizing that you feel, all this is consciousness. So God is that which exists between you and me. Consciousness is that which exists between you and me. And just let your awareness expand in that recognition. This, one of the names for that space of consciousness that exists between you and me is the we space, the space of we-ness. It's the awareness that opens up when we become conscious of our connection, when we recognize that we're connected through a current of awareness that transcends and includes our individual experience and presence. And when two or more people recognize the we space and attend to it as we're doing at this moment, then we experience what I like to call relational enlightenment. In other words, just in being aware of the subtlety of the awareness that we share, we are actually mutually tuning in to the enlightened spaciousness. So when we recognize ourselves as a shared consciousness, as space between you and me, we are entering awake consciousness through another door, just as when we inquire, who am I, and are able to sense the space of pure awareness, we are entering into the space of consciousness through that door. And we as contemporary spiritual practitioners, perhaps because of the experience of virtual reality that's so much a part of our lives, but perhaps because it's always been that way, is that the relational enlightenment, the pure we space, which is unconditioned by particular attachments, you know, because many of us don't necessarily know the other souls are present here in this space, that pure we space can be shared, can be entered, just by becoming aware of the subtle energetic presence that's undulating, pulsating in our field, in our shared field. So that shared etheric spaciousness that we're all connected to is unity. And they're really two simultaneous truths that we're holding right now. Unity, the shared space of consciousness, which is much, much bigger than our consciousness group, but also can be experienced through our consciousness group. and diversity, the experience of our personal individual self. So when we hold these two truths together, this is directly from the Master, this is from Vachista, we are enlightened. Enlightenment is the capacity to hold our individuality and unity together. Or let's say that's one experience of enlightenment. And again, as so many of you have been experiencing over the months and years that you've been doing practice and doing this class, we can be enlightened in a flash. And that experience of being present in consciousness as consciousness can just arise for a moment and then be covered over by our vasanas, by the movements of our mind. And in fact, there have been a couple of very beautiful sharings on the listserv today about that exact experience of how all of us, in fact, certainly been my experience many times, is that there'll be that opening, that sense of delight or enchantment or awakeness, and then there'll be a very heavy, almost like a counter movement of consciousness to more heaviness, more stuckness, and characteristic vasanas. The word vasana, we'll discuss it in a moment, but it in this context it means tendencies, mental emotional tendencies. All of which, you know, we all have all of them, but generally speaking, what comes up is you know, perhaps despair, as one person shared, or just this feeling of being stuck or heavy or, you know, or angry. So it's almost as if the movement of consciousness, which brings us into expanded states, has an equal and opposite reaction of contracting us. And this is, in fact, the way consciousness moves. It expands and contracts in Kashmir Shaiva terms. It opens and it closes. It comes forward and it flows back. So in a certain sense, this process of opening and then contracting is a natural movement. But on a deeper level, for people like you, for people like us, it is actually part of the enlightenment process, because that open, enlightened experience, the experience of grace coming through the teachings, actually shines a light on your consciousness, and buried particles of contracted consciousness kind of come up as if like the, you know, like what happens in a boiling stew, the vegetables and the little slices of chicken and whatever is in the stew, they bubble to the surface. And, or even better, this is a better analogy, when you have a stew and there's a lot of fat in it and you want to render the fat, you take a spoon and you skim that fat bubbles to the surface and you skim it off. And that is actually, it's actually a much better description of the process, because as the, let's call them impurities, as the stuff comes to the surface, they actually get dissolved in the light of your awareness. And we're going to discuss that later on, because it's a primary activity of awake consciousness, is to become the laser that dissolves the obstructions, the vasanas in your consciousness, simply by allowing them to be seen. So you can return to the experience of the breath flowing in and out of the nostrils. To the experience of your body as hollow. And as you tune into your inner body as hollow under the skin, as filled with space under the skin, also see if you can notice the movements of thoughts or sensations that are arising. So with the breath, let yourself enter more deeply into the hollow body. Let your consciousness enter more deeply into your body, experiencing it, recognizing it in this moment as a hollow space surrounded by a thin membrane of skin. And as you settle into that inner spaciousness, sense its qualities of pulsation, the subtle pulsation. It's always a part of our consciousness. And also the way in which you're experiencing thoughts, and also the sound of my voice at this moment. Do you feel as though you're inside the hollow body, inside the spaciousness of the hollow body, and the thoughts, my voice, are outside? And if so, can you consciously open up, now open up the sense of the body's boundaries? And see if you can recognize for a moment that the thoughts are arising inside the space, which is the space of awareness. Can you see them genuinely actually popping up inside the space of awareness? And can you recognize this voice as also being experienced inside the space of awareness? Ask yourself this question that we've been asking. Is this world, this voice, this experience, this room, is it inside my awareness? Or is my awareness inside this room, this world, this space? My awareness inside this body, or is this body inside my awareness? And just notice what happens. These questions that Vasishtha wants us to ask, is my awareness inside the body, or is the body inside awareness, or who are you really, or is this a dream? These questions have been asked for thousands of years, and some of you, because you've done a lot of reading, you're very well educated, have asked these questions over and over again. And yet, every time we really ask, something happens, there's a shift. Vasishtha says, and you may recognize this, that the experience of awareness opening up, of recognizing your underlying self, your consciousness self, that experience can never become a memory. In other words, it doesn't work to remember that you once had that experience, or that you once asked yourself, who am I really, and had a recognition. That awakening can never be an object of memory, or an object that you hold on to or cling to,
or even that you desire. Because it's always an experience of the knower, the knowingness, the consciousness. And sometimes it comes so quickly that we don't even recognize what it is. In the story of Queen Shudala and King Shikidwaja that we told last week, there are actually, if you read the story as it appears in the Concise Yoga Vasishta, which I know some of you did, there are a lot of stories inside the story that she tells her husband. And one of them is a story about a man who went looking for the Philosopher's Stone. The Philosopher's Stone was the Holy Grail for medieval alchemists, as most of you know. And there are actually two definitions of the Philosopher's Stone. One is that it was an actual hunk of a jewel that a person who had it could use it to turn base metal into gold. So it was the secret magical formula for getting rich. The other definition, which we could say is a deeper definition, is that the Philosopher's Stone is the knowledge, the awareness that comes out of meditation and contemplation that can alchemize your mind and allow you to live ecstatically. But this guy was looking for the first Philosopher's Stone, the one that makes you rich. And he'd gotten a mantra, which various charlatans used to give greedy and ignorant people who fell for the con. These magicians would give you a mantra, which was supposed to make the Philosopher's Stone appear. But this guy had gotten a good mantra, and he's sitting in meditation and opens his eyes, and suddenly there's this diamond on the ground, and he goes, is that the Philosopher's Stone? That can't be the Philosopher's Stone. I've only been meditating for about 5 minutes. So he closes his eyes, goes back into meditation, opens his eyes again. It's gone. So this is, Shudala tells this story to remind her husband that you can get it completely. It's there. It's such a simple moment when you experience a moment of stillness and you just sense the spaciousness of yourself. And if you don't recognize it for what it is, if you don't value it, if you go, which many of us do, oh, okay, that's that, I have that experience, now let me get on with my very important daily activities, without allowing it to unfold, then it disappears and you're sort of back doing your practice, wondering when it's going to happen. So, here we are, our attention now for this moment is with the breath, with the flow of breath in and out of the nostrils. Now, the practice of vichara. Let yourself look backwards into the very mind that is giving you the experience of thinking, the experience of being yourself. Look into your own mind, and I'm suggesting that you turn your inner gaze backwards, because for some reason this is a very good way of turning back on yourself. And just ask yourself in this moment, in what are my thoughts arising? In what are my sensations arising? See if you can discern how in your consciousness, thoughts, feelings, sensations, and also my voice which is an object of perception, is arising, and beyond it, behind it, there is a suchness that is aware of all this. See if you can look into the suchness, into the awareness within which all the different facets of your experience are arising and dissolving. Be present with that aware presence, that knowingness. Let yourself just tune to that which is the background of experience, the knower of experience. And just for this moment, see if you can renounce the tendency to identify yourself with any of the thoughts or with your physical sensations. If you can let yourself be that very alive, very subtle, very intelligent, awaring, knowing, presencing. Within which experience is rising and falling. Within which mood is rising and falling. Within which agitation or sleepiness is rising and falling. So you can be present with the breath. You can sense the breath flowing in and out of the nostrils. You can notice the thoughts and the awareness within which they arise. And the purpose of this practice, of course, and again, we're going to come back to it several times in this class, is to see if you can, even for a second, identify yourself with that awareing, which means letting go, even for a second, of attaching yourself to the content of the thoughts, or of owning the sensations in your body. So as we practice tuning into awareness, again, it happens sometimes just for a second or two, and then all those questions arise. Is this it? How does this work? Am I getting it right? Oh my God, that's it. That's it. Okay, let me stay with that. All those reactions are part of course, the egoic process of identification, and it's one of the reasons that the practice of vichara leads to a certain degree of frustration, and why this experience of frustration is so important. We're going to get there in a second. But as we practice disentangling awareness from identifying with the body-mind, we begin to get a deeper felt sense, felt experience of awareness as our ground. It's a felt experience. It's not just an intellectual experience. And the reason that it's a felt experience, or there's no such thing as reason, but its nature includes feeling, because, to use the language of Kashmir Shaivism, it's both pure subjectivity and also filled with movement, with pulsation. It's still and it's dynamic. It's Shiva Shakti. It's I am. I, the pure subject, which doesn't identify itself with anything, and the capacity of that I-ness, that subject, to experience itself. So awareness is that sense of self without an object experiencing itself, without any senses. And for some of you, it might be very copacetic to do this by actually bringing your awareness above and behind the palate, or even outside the body. I first discovered this experience by moving my attention outside and a little bit above the head, and that was when this kind of sky of awareness opened up to me for the first time. Some of you may experience it by the hollow body practice that we just did, which is a very, very classical, much loved practice from the Vijnana Bhairava and also from Tantric Buddhism. And according to Vasishtha, all the other practices that we do, and of course, each of the practices that we do has its own greatness and its own effect and its own significance. The fact is that the real transformation of the mind comes about by discovering and opening up to this source of the mind, which is awareness. That simple, these are Adyashanti's words, he calls it garden variety awareness, your ordinary awareness, which as you let yourself be present with it, shows you that it's completely one with the vastness. So the transformation which occurs through practices other than simply letting yourself dissolve into awareness. The transformation of the mind that occurs through mantra, through pranayama, through positive thinking, through devotional practices, they work through the principle known as vasana. And vasana has several different meanings, but essentially what it describes is our conditioning. So in Sanskrit, there are two words that are used to describe the tendencies that define us as individuals. One is samskara, which, as has been pointed out, often rhymes with some scars, and that is what they are. Some scars are the grooves in consciousness, or let's say the neuronal pathways that are left in our awareness, in our brain, by thoughts and memories and impressions. Vasanas are deeper. At least that's what Vasishtha says. There are schools of thought that believe that vasanas are less deep than samskaras, but Vasishtha says that they're deeper. So samskara is one stage of the process of creating grooves in consciousness. Vasana is another. So when you look into your awareness, I'm going to ask you to do it once again. What you probably notice that there are some channels through which the energy of your mind tends to flow more freely. And if you spend some time examining your own awareness, you will, and many of you have already, begun to recognize these channels. They are what we experience as moods and as classic ways of being yourself, and that the most characteristic channels, the ones that we're most aware of, are the channels that are just busily identifying yourself. You know, this is me, this is my meditation, this is my mind, this is my body. These basic channels of identifying with your particular individual's body-mind experience. These are the vasanas, the characteristic set of tendencies that keep you thinking of yourself as a human being in all the different ways that you do. So the word vasana in many parts of the country means fragrance or smell, which is really interesting, because in the same way that each of us has a characteristic smell, our body has a certain smell. And when you get close to somebody, you smell their characteristic smell. That's, you know, that some people it's a very attractive smell, others it's not so attractive. Vasanas are like this too. They are the fragrance of our tendencies, which we actually cannot disguise. No matter if you've been, I'll give you a sort of a gross example. Most people's natural fragrance is not so obvious, especially if they've bathed and, you know, their soap smell is covering them, or if you're just not that close to them. But if you've been cutting onions or eating a lot of garlic, then your fragrance is, you know, it's very difficult to avoid. You can smell it from across the room. And even if you put on perfume, if you haven't fully washed your hands from the onion smell, people are going to smell it. So your mental conditioning, your vasanas, are actually like that. And we can refine our vasanas, and many of us do. As we grow up, we're conditioned in all sorts of ways. Many of us spend our lifetime refining our childhood conditioning, that is working with our vasanas, so that we learn to substitute, let's say, more productive vasanas for some of the ones that we acquired in childhood that didn't feel so good or weren't so helpful. But it's our vasanas, essentially, which are the source of our karmas, of our karmic circumstances, and also which are the source of our happiness or suffering, our happiness and sorrow. And I find in considering vasana, I find that the new science of epigenetics really helpful and interesting. And those of you who keep up with these things will know that epigenetics is the name for a field of genetics that's arisen fairly recently, you know, that just as we used to believe that the brain was, kind of grow to a certain point and then be fixed, then it would stop and the brain cells would die off. Well, now we know that brains are plastic. They can change. and the neuronal pathways can change, which is, you know, incredibly good news for spiritual practitioners. In the same way, and this is kind of even more mind-blowing to me, the science of epigenetics says that our DNA is not fixed either. Our experiences, the physical experiences, environmental experiences, you know, like, for example, the fresh air in the forest or the chemicals, fire retardant chemicals in your sofa, all of these affect DNA. And our thoughts and feelings and the culture around us affect our DNA as well. So, for example, if you spend your time in a culture in which everybody recognizes love and spiritual practice as high values and treats you as, you know, as consciousness, as the self, as a being with infinite dignity, worthy of love, that experience coming from outside is actually going to affect your genome. It's going to shift your DNA, and the opposite experience will as well. But your thoughts and feelings have a profound effect on your DNA. Bruce Lipton has written a really interesting book called The Biology of Belief, which many of you have read, which examines this. So vasana is incredibly important, and it's expressed physically. It's also expressed on a subtle level through our subtle body, our energy body, and even into our causal body, which we aren't at all conscious of because the causal body is the body we inhabit in deep sleep. But it's also, according to the, you know, to the Yoga Vasishta in the Indian system, it's where our deepest vasanas, our karmic, the karmic seeds are stored. And so here's what Vasishta says about vasana. And it's an interesting fact about his teachings that even though he's such a radical non-dualist, he's constantly telling us that everything is consciousness and there is no differentiation. He also differentiates. And vasanas, he says, can be either pure or impure. Our conditioning, in other words, can be either helpful, that is, allow us to see through the veils, or unhelpful, add more veils to the ones we're already experiencing. And he compares vasana to the coating on a mirror or to the prescription of your glasses. So there's, you know, there are some glasses that improve your vision. Others tint it. And then there are glasses, if you put on glasses with the wrong prescription, they'll distort your vision. So, and it's the same with vasanas. So people have been asking questions about karma, and karma is all about vasana. So our karmic situation here in this lifetime and in our moment-to-moment experience is pretty much determined by our vasanas. The vasanas that we came in with, that we brought in from our past thoughts and actions, also the vasanas that we have cultivated in ourselves since childhood. So remember, Vasishta says that karma, that past life experience, past life fate, past vasanas, can be overcome by your effort to create new vasanas in the present. This is one of his core teachings, and therefore he says that somebody who says that fate is determining my life is actually being a fool, because even though, yes, we do carry past vasanas, what we're doing now has considerably more power than anything from the past. And I think many of you recognize this. It's certainly been my experience in this lifetime that all the spiritual work I've done has transformed my consciousness, and I assume it's transformed my DNA as well. I experience myself very differently now than I did when I was 25, and it's because of spiritual practice, and I know that's true for many of you. And that said, there are certain tendencies, certain vasanas that are very hard to eradicate, and they're the vasanas that tend to come up for us at fairly advanced stages of spiritual practice. Or shall I say, even at fairly advanced stages of spiritual practice, because they're very deeply rooted, or because we haven't been able to stand aside from them. In other words, there are certain thoughts and feelings that you identify with, and to stop identifying with them is a very big deal. For example, the feeling of abandonment, which many people experience perhaps from early childhood, perhaps from former lives. For some people, that doesn't go away over the course of a lifetime. Several people have talked about despair arising. I talked to someone last night who said that she's met somebody who totally loves her, and she's experiencing herself as she's experiencing a vasana, even though she wants to be with this person. She's experiencing a very deep-seated vasana that tells her, no, this is a trap. I don't want to commit myself to one person. She has this fragrance in her of non-commitment. So we all have our own. But the process of transforming our mind on the level in which most of us engage in it is the process of transforming our vasanas. So if you look back at your life, you will recognize that you have succeeded in transforming certain vasanas, and this is the result of your work, of your inner work. Okay, let's just stop for a moment and feel the breath flowing in and out through the nostrils. Feel the coolness on the inhalation, the warmth on the exhalation. See if you can notice the prevailing vasanas that you're experiencing in this moment. I think that for many of you, part of the experience of this moment is the sweetness of tuning into this teaching. For some of you are experiencing the vasanas of confusion. Some of you, the vasanas of distraction. Some of you, the vasanas of deep meditation. And what you may be aware of is that the vasanas, the states you experience now, many of them are habitual. They're familiar. And what Vasishtha says is that the mistaken identification, this is really important, the mistaken identification that leads us into being trapped by our personal vasanas is the belief that this thought pattern, this energy vortex, this mood is you, is yours. So as long as you feel that boredom is your boredom, that despair is your despair, that happiness is your despair, you're going to be caught in the energy vortex of these different habit patterns. And what Vasishtha says, and this to me was a really transformative idea, is that none of these habit patterns belong to any one of us individually. They're like energy. I love the word energy vortex. They're like energy vortexes that float around in the ether of consciousness, like radio waves. So radio waves are everywhere, but you have to have the right receiver to tune into it, to the station, to my local station, KAZU. You can't get it when you're driving up the highway. When you get to Watsonville, you have to tune into another different NPR station. So in the same way, vasanas are like radio stations. They're like channels. So there is a shame vortex. There's a romantic love vortex. There's a hatred vortex. There's an insulted vortex. There's a irritability vortex. There's a sarcasm vortex. There's a cynicism vortex. There are literally vortexes in consciousness. And if you notice, when you fall in love, even though you're an individual in love with another individual, the feeling of being in love is utterly universal. When you fall romantically in love, you actually fall into the energy, the vasana, the energy pool of romantic love, which is, in a certain sense, a shared habit pattern in this universe, in our particular human world. In the same way, when you fall into the shame bind, when you have a shame attack, as Brené Brown, the popular and hilarious and skillful shame expert, says, she calls it a shame attack, it is actually as though you've fallen into the shame vortex. It's just right there yawning, and and something happens that triggers it, and we fall into it. So the same is true for spiritual feelings. They have vortexes. Spiritual traditions are vortexes. So, for instance, I think that many of you have this experience that you can walk into a room anywhere in the world where people do devotional practice, for example, and you'll feel the waves of that. If you're tuned to the Buddhist energy vortex, there'll be a sense of at-homeness when you walk into a place that's working with that particular set of vasanas. And the more energetically sensitive you become, the more possible it becomes, the more you recognize yourself tuning to the vasanas in the ether, in the noosphere. But the moment that you say, my shame, my teacher, my love, my lover, my anger, the moment you identify with it, then you're in it. You've bought it. You own it. And that's what Vasishtha and the sages of Vedanta call Maya. I mean, this is so simple, and it's so kind of radical when you get it. So, what Vasishtha says is that whatever arises in our outer life, which we've already established is not actually happening outside, but as far as we're concerned, this room that you're in is outside you. And if somebody comes into your room and starts screaming at you, you're going to be challenged as to the vasanas that arise in relationship to it. So, generally speaking, if somebody comes into the room and screams at you, you're going to react either with anger, with irritation, with defensiveness, with the feeling of, oh my God, what did I do? With fear. You'll have one of a series of reactions depending on your nature and your vasanas. So the process of transforming your relationship to your vasanas happens on the inside in our inquiry practice, but it also happens in your attentiveness to the vasanas that arise in reaction to what seems to be the outer environment. In other words, in meditation, in inner inquiry, you can have, and many of you do have, experiences of pure clarified consciousness. And in those moments of clarified consciousness, you actually are free of vasana. And you can, this is another example, you can work with emotions, with inner moods and feelings very skillfully. We work with some of our patterns and habits and emotions and karmic tendencies in some of the telecourses, and you've worked with other teachers and other methods for letting emotions dissolve. And it is, in short, absolutely possible to, through close attention, inner work practice, and a lot of grace, to really dissolve and transform a lot of our vasanas. The thing is, and this is really, if there is one secret is the most important secret for somebody who's serious about their practice. The thing is, when it dissolves, you have to be able not to pick it up again. In other words, if you pick it up again, and that doesn't mean it's not going to arise. You know, for example, if you work with your anger, as we did in the Playing Your Edge class, by imaginatively dissolving it in a fire, and you do this again and again, you will start to notice that your anger no longer has such a grip on you. You've created some distance between yourself and the experience of being angry. And over time, as you work with the roots of your vasanas, what often starts to happen is that you move back to the moment in consciousness when you first became stuck to this particular karmic feeling. And if at that moment you can become aware of awareness and hold that felt sense inside awareness, and I'm going to give you a practice for this later, as your homework, then you can actually dissolve a karmic patterning pretty much completely if you can manage to get back to the source feeling. But then what happens is that you have to walk away from it and not be saying to yourself, oh my God, that was such a terrible experience. I'm so glad I got rid of that feeling. It felt so bad. And let me just go back and make sure it's really dissolved. And in that moment of going back, you re-enter it because the vortex of vasanas is so powerful. You know, it's like that. There's an old Jewish story about a guy who's on a train, and he's an old man on the train. And he's saying, "Oh, I am so thirsty. Oh, I'm so thirsty." This is a Yiddish story, so he's speaking in Yiddish. "I'm so thirsty, I'm so thirsty." And then a passenger gives him a glass of water. He drinks the water. He has a big sigh of relief, and then he says, "Oh boy, was I thirsty. Oh, I was so thirsty. Oh my God, I was so thirsty." Do you know that feeling? And that's actually what we do to re-enter a samskara even after we've been freed of it. The process that Vasishtha is trying to get us to recognize is that what's going on the outside, what the events that trigger our feelings are actually, and the feelings themselves are kind of mechanical. They're like puppets. They're like the old Punch and Judy shows, or like one of those video games where you knock the bowling ball down and it pops up again. You knock the bowling pin down, it pops up again. Or the trick birthday candle where you blow it out and it comes back up again. It's a trick. It's literally a mechanical process. So the practice, once you've begun to be able to become aware of awareness and rest in it, is that you watch these feelings and thoughts, desires, craving, anger, anxiety, coming up, arising. You accept it, you feel it. And you let it move on, which it will. You let it move on. You actually observe it. You strongly observe it. You let yourself be with it. Without going, oh my God, this is terrible, or oh my God, this is so great. You just let yourself be with it, fully feel it. And in that process, you're able to dissolve the vasanas. So, just for a moment, consider a situation in your life that you find frustrating. And I know that some of you are in a state where you can't find a frustrating situation, but just see if you can imagine a situation that normally brings you down. That creates pain or confusion for you. And now we're going to do fundamental vichara. Ask yourself, who or what is upset by this, or angered by this, or frustrated by this, or hurt by this? Who or what is hurt? And again, answers are going to come. You're going to say, you're going to think I am, or you're going to think, oh, it's just my mind. You'll think, what's the correct answer here? But don't go for the answering words. Just ask the question, who or what is upset by this? And as you ask the question, see if you can move beyond the identification with the upset, with the feeling of being upset. Just stay with the question and notice how your attention turns from the felt sense of being upset to the question, who is upset? And now, what is aware of the upset, the process, the questioning? Who or what is aware of what's happening in this moment? And just see if you can literally let yourself fall backwards into that. Just rest for a moment in that awareness, which is actually the knowing observer. And with the breath flowing in and out of the nostrils, turn your attention a little bit deeper and ask yourself, what is this awareness that knows my experience at this moment? What is this awareness? Where is it? Where is it? What is awareness for me now? Where is it? And just see if you can recognize the spaciousness of presence that is there behind the thoughts. Here's a story. This is one of the stories that Vashistha tells Rama. There's a great rock, which is full of tenderness and affection. That's right, he says rock. Which is obvious and ever clearly perceived. Which is soft, which is omnipresent and eternal. Within it, countless lotuses blossom. Their petals sometimes touch one another, sometimes not. Sometimes they are exposed, and sometimes they are hidden from view. Some face downwards, some face upwards, and some have their roots intertwined. Some have no roots at all. All things exist within this rock, though they do not. O Rama, this rock is indeed the cosmic consciousness. It is rock-like in its homogeneity. Yet within it, all diverse creatures of this universe appear to be. Just as one conceives or imagines different forms within the rock, the universe is also imagined to exist in this consciousness. Even if a sculptor creates different forms in the rock, it is still rock. Even so, in the case of this cosmic consciousness, which is a homogeneous mass of consciousness and bliss, even as a solid rock contains potentially diverse figures which can be carved out of it, the diverse names and forms of the creatures of this universe exist potentially in cosmic consciousness. Even as the rock remains rock, carved or uncarved, consciousness remains consciousness whether the world appears or not. In fact, even those modifications and manifestations are simply cosmic consciousness itself. Since the seed does not contain anything other than its seedness, even the flowers and the fruits are of the same nature as the seed. Even so, this homogeneous mass of cosmic consciousness does not give rise to anything other than what it is in essence. When this truth is realized, duality ceases. Consciousness never becomes unconsciousness. If there is modification, that too is consciousness. Hence, whatever there may be, wherever and in whatever form, all this is Brahman. All this is consciousness. All this, everything of which your body and my body consists, every thought, every feeling, all these exist forever in the mass of homogeneous consciousness. So, one of the distinctions within the vast homogeneous consciousness that Vashistha emphasizes is that everyone and everything is subject to conditioning. So even after realizing the truth, you still have vasana. Conditioning is actually another word for contraction or self-limitation, for the natural tendency of consciousness to take on limitation, to create individuation within itself, for this to identify with the qualities of body and mind. But he says there are two types of conditioning, and that's very significant for us. There's what he calls sterile or binding conditioning, which is the conditioning that creates suffering. And Vashistha, like Buddha, says that all suffering is created by our vasanas, by our condition, by our conditioning, by our identifying with the vasanas that make us attached to pleasure and trying to avoid pain. But so sterile conditioning is really the conditioning that starts with not understanding who we are, to getting identified with our vasanas and looking for pleasure outside ourselves and blaming the outside for our pain, all these normal conditions of human life. The adorable conditioning, he says, is the conditioning of enlightened beings. who literally are volunteers in the game of life because they've chosen to use their individuality as in service to help others. And the Shista also says that those beings whom we call deities, for example, Vishnu and Shiva and the goddesses, or the great teachers like Christ and Buddha, are actually expressions of consciousness which has chosen to accept limitation for the sake of protecting the world or awakening the world. And those who have adorable conditioning, including deities and enlightened beings, are free because they know the self, because they don't identify anymore, or at least not for more than a moment, with their ideas about themselves. Their activities are what the Buddhists call bodhisattva activities, that is, activities that arise compassionately out of awakened consciousness. And, you know, all of you have had the experience of bodhisattva activity at one time or another. You know, that capacity for acting without identifying with the action and for the sake of helping is a natural experience in human consciousness. Empathy and compassion are natural, and they don't have to be binding, although, you know, when we are in a state of conditioned vasana, we'll often identify with it and say, oh, that was really good of me. But in the moment, very often, you know, we experience enlightened activity. And one reason why the Yoga Vishista is so powerful is because it arises out of Vishista's enlightened activity. So what he's pointing out here is that our aim is not to dissolve into consciousness, although we may choose to do that. It's to become free in life by realizing the nature of the mind. And this text was spoken by Vishista to Rama, who was a prince and who would go on to become a king. And the thing is that if you remember the story of the Ramayana, Rama did not have an easy life. You know, a little while after this conversation, he's banished by his father from the kingdom. His wife, Sita, is kidnapped, and he has to fight a war to get her back. He then becomes a king and rules the kingdom, and, you know, various tragedies occur, including losing Sita again. So Rama doesn't have a life of just sitting on a cushion, and he certainly doesn't disappear from the world. He lives his life in an enlightened state, in a state of adorable vasana, knowing that he is the truth, knowing that he is the self. And what Vishista tells us, which is sort of, let's say, the frame of this text, is that our process of transforming the mind, of wake, which is actually the process of waking up, has stages, and all of us go through these stages. So the moment when you begin to ask yourself, why am I suffering? Where does this suffering come from? And you begin to realize that your suffering is to a large degree the result of the way you're holding your experience. In other words, when you really recognize that it's nobody's fault, you know, and this is, you know, we can't always stay in that place, but when we generally realize that we're responsible for our own experience and begin to look at the mind and the way in which it's creating thoughts and feelings that lead us towards suffering, then we begin to try and change it. But the thing is, beyond a certain point, we can't really understand the mind through the mind. So when we ask the question, what's life? What's the truth about life? Who am I really? These questions, they give birth to to what in Sanskrit is called subhecha, which means auspicious desire, the longing to know what's real, the longing for the love that doesn't go away, the longing for the truth. And this auspicious desire, this subhecha, starts to lead you deeper towards the truth of who you are. Even if it's a very mild desire, it has a kind of momentum, like, you know, like a forest fire. It burns a little bit more fuel. It becomes stronger and stronger. And this takes you, it takes you into the experience of, the deeper experience, which is called vicharana. And vicharana is related to vichara or inquiry, but it's different because it comes from the recognition that you cannot wish suffering away. You cannot make your suffering go away. It's, you can't pretend it's not there. You can't run away from it. You can take Prozac or Zoloft, but at some point they stop working. Because the fundamental sorrow of life is beyond biochemistry. So what happens then is that you begin to observe it. We've talked about this earlier. You begin to directly observe sorrow. You feel it. You just let yourself be with it without naming it or resisting it or trying to run away from it or cure it. And as you do this, something happens. The mind races around looking for a cure, and you keep bringing it back, and the mind stops racing. It becomes still. It's our racing around trying to feel better or make someone else feel better that creates the agitation. So as you look directly into the experience of sorrow, what happens is that your mind becomes more and more transparent. This stage is called Tanumanasi, the transparent mind. Your desire to feel better begins to dissolve a little bit. Your self-centeredness begins to dissolve a bit. It's like looking into a mirror when the silver backing has been removed. Instead of seeing your own reflection, instead of seeing your own neediness or your own anger mirrored back to you, you start to see through the glass of your mind. You actually begin to be able to look through the mind and see the inner reality as it is, thoughts arising, the squirrel running across the lawn, your wife's face, which is so familiar, suddenly becomes a new face, and you start to be able to see into the process by which craving leads to disappointment, in which the attempt to make yourself happy is what gives rise to sorrow. In the moment that you think something is going to make you feel better, whatever it is, sorrow and disappointment are born, and you start to recognize that it's your dependence on external conditions that create the experience of sorrow. And I want to say here, this doesn't mean you should stop trying to change things or make the world better. It's really about what it is to become free in your actions. And as you continue with this process, you get to the stage which Vaishishtha calls Padartha Bhavana. This is a really subtle state. Bhavana means attitude or feeling. Abhavana means without feeling. Pada and Artha mean the word and the object that the word signifies. So Padartha means the word and its meaning. Padartha Abhavana means the absence of meaning. And this is the realization that experience means what you think it means. In other words, if you give a sensation the name of painful, you experience it as pain. If you give the sensation the name of pleasure, you experience it as pleasurable. And as you know, there are certain sensations that are pleasurable to the point where the pleasure becomes pain, and painful to the point where the pain becomes pleasure. So in this state of Padartha Abhavana, you recognize that all meaning is conferred by your own attitude. So you're experiencing your life, but you're not saying, this is so great, I want more of it, or this is painful, now make it go away. You're just there. You're with your life, which sometimes feels good and sometimes doesn't. And you can experience sorrow and pain without thinking that there's something wrong with that, even though, of course, you use certain pain as a signal. You know, if your arm hurts, you change your position and you get an MRI or whatever is appropriate. But you don't go, I have to get rid of this pain or I can't be happy. And when you don't get something you want, or when something that you didn't want happens, you deal with it. Of course you do. But you don't identify with the me who's disappointed. You might stay present with the feeling of disappointment and examine it. But your well-being doesn't rise and fall with hope and fear, because more and more you're identifying with the awareness that's present to all of us. And this is the state of awakened consciousness, the state of freedom. Even more mysteriously, it really is the state of unconditional love. Because as your mind becomes more and more transparent, as you begin to be able to let your experience arise and subside, just as you recognize that awareness is always present, love is always present, because your awareness is made of love just as it's made of knowledge. And in that self-recognition, you become the ecstatic awakened being that Vishista is pointing us towards. So, as we bring this third class to a close for now, allow yourself to be present with the breath. And as you look inside towards your awareness, you can, if you like, allow yourself to move down towards the center that we call the heart, the center in the chest. And let the breath bring your awareness into the heart and backwards through the heart. And with your inner gaze turned back on itself, tuning into the presence, the awareness, that is subtly there behind your listening, behind your sensation. Ask yourself, who am I really? Who am I really? And allow that presence that's always lurking, ready to be called forth, to show you that it is what you are. Just let that be there. And we'll close with the beautiful sounds of Nirvanashtakam. And you can meditate with this enlightened thought.
am not the mind nor the prana. I am not consciousness, or I'm not unconsciousness, sleep, or hunger. I am not what would be worth it.
Chidananda Shivu.